Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Jeremiah 49. We're going to look at the last half or last portion of chapter 49. In our previous audio, as we looked at verses 1 through 22 of chapter 49, we see God, through Jeremiah, pronouncing judgment on Ammon, Edom. And now, in verses 23 through 39, the last part of the chapter, we'll see Yahweh pronouncing judgment on Syria, Arabia, and Elam. So we start now in verses 23 through 27. Concerning Damascus, Hamath and Arpad are dismayed, for they have heard bad news. They are disheartened, troubled like the restless sea. Damascus has become feeble. She has turned to flee, and panic has gripped her. Anguish and pain have seized her, pain like that of a woman in labor. Why has the city of renown not been abandoned, the town in which I delight? Surely her young men will fall in the streets. All her soldiers will be silenced in that day, declares the Lord Almighty. I will set fire to the walls of Damascus. It will consume the fortresses of Ben-Hadad. So our first prophecy for today is against Damascus. Damascus, of course, is a metonymy for Syria, Damascus being the capital. Hamath and Arpad are dismayed. Those are two prominent cities in Syria. If you look at the map, you look at the Cilicia Valley, where the Orontes River is between the Lebanon Range and the Anti-Lebanon Range. The Orontes River runs from the upper regions of that valley and then runs south to north, going down until it eventually enters into the Mediterranean Sea, right at the northeastern corner of that sea. And on the way, you will see Hamath right there on the river, about halfway. Hamath is on the road that goes from south to north to Aleppo, that famous city in Syria. Arpad is about maybe 12 miles or so to the north-northeast of Aleppo. So they're just two Syrian cities that Jeremiah mentions. They've heard bad news. They're disheartened. They're troubled like the restless sea. It's a good metaphor. You think about the sea sloshing the waves around in a during a dark night. Damascus is feeble now. She's turned to flee in panic, anguish, and pain, like a woman in labor, that famous metaphor that Old Testament prophets like to use, a woman being very afraid because she's might die in childbirth, and she's in a lot of pain. Verse 25, why has the city of renown not been abandoned? In other words, why is there anybody still in this city that hasn't run yet? Because you need to be running, because the Babylonians are coming. Now, in verse 25, Damascus is called a city of renown. That's the NIV translation. Other translations have the city of praise. Why is Damascus so renowned and so praised? Damascus was famous for its antiquity, its wealth, its riches, its strength, and its power. UNESCO.org says that Damascus is one of the oldest continuously existing city in the world. I saw one website said it was about 11,000 years old if you look at archaeology. Damascus was famous with the heathens for its devotion, for its superstition. Julian the Apostate said that Damascus was, quote, the truly city of Jupiter, the eye of the whole East, Damascus the holy and the greatest. The Turks relate this story of their prophet Muhammad, quote, coming near Damascus, he took his station at a high precipice in order to view it, and considering the ravishing beauty and delightfulness of it, he would not tempt his frailty by entering into it, but instantly departed with this reflection on it, that there was but one paradise designed for men, and for his part, he was resolved to not take his in this world. In other words, Muhammad thought that Damascus was paradise compared to the heavenly paradise that he erroneously thought he was going to be living in. Now, this city of renown, the city of delight, Jeremiah says in verse 25 that Damascus is the town in which Jeremiah delights. Well, why would Jeremiah delight in Damascus? Well, because Jeremiah is participating in the universal affection that the ancient world held for Damascus. This is Albert Barnes' idea. Barnes quotes 2 Kings 5, verse 12. This is Naaman the Syrian. In that famous story, if you recall, Syria is attacking Israel. Naaman is the general. He catches leprosy. And the prophet tells Naaman to go wash in the Jordan. And Naaman responds, aren't Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and left in a rage. Well, Naaman thought that the two rivers of Damascus were better than any river in Israel. He, of course, might have been biased since he was from Syria, but I don't know. That seems to be somewhat of a weak verse to cite. I think this quote about Muhammad is better. People love Damascus, but God says, I don't care. You're going down. In verse 26, the young men of Damascus will fall in the streets. All her soldiers will be silenced in that day. Well, what day was that? Here is from the article on Damascus from Wikipedia. In 572 BC, all of Syria had been conquered by Nebuchadnezzar II of the Neo-Babylonians. But the status of Damascus under Babylon is relatively unknown. So there's not a lot of history here, but we know that all of Syria had been wiped out by 572. So sometime before 572, Syria is blasted. Of course, Jerusalem got blasted in 586. So somewhere around that time, Babylon came and wiped out Syria. Now in verse 27, God says that fire will consume the fortresses of Ben-Hadad. That's the typical name of a king of Syria. Does not necessarily mean a particular guy named Ben-Hadad. It could be, but not necessarily. Hadad is the name of an idol they worship, so Ben-Hadad is son of Hadad. We go now to Jeremiah 49, verses 28 through 33, concerning Kedar. We're finished now with Damascus. It's toast. Now we go to Kedar and the kingdoms of Hazar. Concerning Kedar and the kingdoms of Hazar, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, attacked. This is what the Lord says. Arise and attack Kedar and destroy the people of the east. Their tents and their flocks will be taken. Their shelters will be carried off with all their goods and camels. Men will shout to them, terror on every side. Flee quickly away. Stay in deep caves, you who live in Hazor, declares the Lord. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has plotted against you. He has devised a plan against you. Arise and attack a nation at ease, which lives in confidence, declares the Lord. A nation that has neither gates nor bars. Its people live alone. Their camels will become plunder, and their large herds will be booty. I will scatter to the winds those who are in distant places and will bring disaster on them from every side, declares the Lord. Hazor will become a haunt of jackals, a desolate place forever. No one will live there. No man will dwell in it. Now, you may have noticed a lot of references to nomadic life in this six-verse passage, and that's because Kedar is Arabia. Kedar was a son of Ishmael, and his posterity inhabited Arabia. I'm going to talk about the different areas of Arabia in just a minute. Kedar means blackness. That's because the sun out there in the desert darkened their skins and made the Bedouins dark. Now, if you'll look up Kedar in BabelAtlas.org, it will immediately send you to Arabia. Now, let's talk about what Arabia is. Well, in the ancient world, Arabia was divided into three Arabias. There was Arabia Felix, Happy Arabia. That was in present-day Yemen, which is the southern strip of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, present-day Yemen. Arabia Petraea is the area we have mostly been concerned with because that is the area that surrounds Israel. If you'll go to the southwest of Israel, go south of the Negev Desert, up to the border of Egypt at the Shur Desert, that's where Arabia Petraea starts. You proceed east and you go into the region between the southern end of the Dead Sea and the northern tip of the Red Sea, basically Edom, that's Arabia Petraea. You cross the Arab Valley, which is south of the Dead Sea, and you go into the area that's east of the Arab Valley that's still a part of Edom, and then you go north a little bit, cross the Zered Brook, and you're in Moab. That's Arabia Petraea. You go north of Moab and get to Ammon, which is east of the southern half of the Jordan River. That's Arabia Petraea. You go north all the way up to the east of the Golan Heights. That's Arabia Petraea. So it's basically that band of desert that surrounds the nation of Israel. It also goes south all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba, halfway down from the Dead to the Red Sea there, the Gulf of Aqaba being on the Red Sea. Halfway down is Petra, the famous city, which I've been to. Beautiful place. You should go there if you have a chance. That's where it got its name, Arabia Petraea. Then there's the third Arabia. That's the Arabia Deserta, or Arabia Magna. Deserta means deserted, and this is a good name because if you'll go a little bit east of Arabia Petraea, you're in that broad expanse of desert that runs between Israel and Babylon. Babylon being on the Euphrates River to the east of it, and Jerusalem being to the west of the Jordan River. So in that area is Arabia Deserta, starting at Syria in the north, going all the way down past the tips of the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea, into the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, all the way down to Arabia Felix, present-day Yemen. That's Arabia Deserta. Keter will stand for all three Arabias, because it's not more precise than that. Now, who lives in Arabia? Bedouins do, because it's nothing but desert. They wander around with their sheep and their tents. Now, in verse 28, Jeremiah's prophecy is said to also concern the kingdoms of Hazor. Now, in a previous audio, I confused Hazor with the Hazor that's right up in the area around Lake Hula, north of the Sea of Galilee, and that was a mistake. Wikipedia says there are many different places called Hazor in the Bible, and referring to this one that's cited by Jeremiah, I'll read this. Hazor, described by the book of Jeremiah as being in the vicinity of Kedar. The text refers to kingdoms of Hazor, which suggests the possibility that this Hazor was the name of a region in the Arab desert. In other words, nobody really knows what this Hazor is. I'm just going to assume it's regions, kingdoms, staked out by some Bedouin tribes in the Arabian desert. Verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, attacked these kingdoms in the desert in Arabia. Now, we have a problem here because this is a prophecy, and yet the past tense is used. Nebuchadnezzar attacked them. Well, they attacked them in Jeremiah's mind. In the vision, Nebuchadnezzar has not attacked the Bedouins of Arabia yet. The King James, interestingly enough, says Nebuchadnezzar shall smite Kedar. Puts it in the future, but none of the other translations do that I saw because I checked them. One of my commentators says that the past is often put for the future in prophetic writing. And this is a very common thing. I know this. I quit trying to prove things by verb tenses a while back. I was teaching a high school English class in China, and I became aware that we use the present tense for the future. For example, today is Monday, and I say, I am going to the store on Wednesday. Am going is a present tense, present progressive tense. I am going to the store on Wednesday. That's in the future. So you use a present tense for the future. There are other examples. If I were a linguist, I could point them out to you, but I'm not going to worry too much about that past tense there. Now, Yahweh says at the end of verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar, please destroy the people of the east, in other words, the Arabians in the desert. Why? What had these Arabians done to offend Yahweh so? Well, it doesn't say. I'm assuming it's idolatry. Verse 29, their tents and their flocks will be taken. There's the tents of a nomad, flocks. That's what nomads have. Their shelters will be carried off, not their houses, but their shelters, probably to hide themselves from the sun as they watch the sheep. Their goods, their camels. Camels are good for the desert. Men will shout to them, terror on every side. Flee quickly away. Stay in deep caves. Get off the desert. Get in the caves. Nebuchadnezzar has plotted against you. He's devised a plan against you. Now, I wonder why Nebuchadnezzar really cared about these Bedouins in the desert, but apparently he did. Verse 31, God tells Nebuchadnezzar to arise and attack a nation at ease. That would be the Arabians, who are taking it easy in the desert. As Gill says, they had no thought nor care to defend themselves from an enemy. They had no fear of any, imagining that no one would think it worthwhile to give themselves any trouble to invade them. Their meanness, they supposed, was a protection to them. It would be a protection to me if I were Nebuchadnezzar. I don't understand why he wanted to attack a bunch of sheep herders in the desert. But the Arabians were mistaken about Nebuchadnezzar. He came. God says, attack this nation at ease, these Arabians, a nation that has neither gates nor bars. That's because they don't have cities. They wander around in the desert, so they don't have cities with city gates and bars on those city gates. This nation has people that live alone. That's because they're in the desert. Their camels will become plunder, and their large herds will be booty. I will scatter to the winds those who are in distant places. Distant places sounds like remote places of the desert. These people who lived alone, being in no alliance with any other nation, not living together in cities, towns, and villages. We go now to Jeremiah 39, verses 34 through 39, and we will finish this audio. We are finished now with prophesied destruction of Arabia, and now we're going to the prophesied destruction of Elam. Verse 34, this is the word of the Lord that came to Jeremiah the prophet concerning Elam early in the reign of Zedekiah. Zedekiah ruled from 597 to 568, and so we can date this prophecy somewhere around 597. This is what the Lord Almighty says. See, I will break the bow of Elam, the mainstay of their might. I will bring against Elam the four winds from the four quarters of the heavens. I will scatter them to the four winds, and there will not be a nation where Elam's exiles do not go. I will shatter Elam before their foes, before those who seek their lives. I will bring disaster upon them, even my fierce anger, declares the Lord. I will pursue them with the sword until I have made an end of them. I will set my throne in Elam and destroy her king and officials, declares the Lord. Yet I will restore the fortunes of Elam in days to come, declares the Lord. So in these six verses, we have a prophecy of the destruction of Elam, finished off by a prophecy of the restoration of Elam. And we need to try to identify the times at which those two events happened. Let's start now and look at some options as to when Elam was destroyed. First option is during the times of Alexander the Great. Alexander conquered Susa, the capital of Elam, in 330 BC. And by the way, Elam is the southwestern region of Persia. It had been an independent kingdom, an ancient Near Eastern kingdom, from several millennia BC. And of course, Alexander famously conquered Persia, and so he also got Susa when he did that. In fact, he conquered Susa, the capital of Elam, in 330 BC. When I say the southwestern corner of Persia, that is right to the west of the Tigris River, right near the head of the Persian Gulf. Livius.org says that after the Battle of Gaugamela, which was October the 1st, 331 BC, Alexander the Great conquered Babylonia and Elam. So that's one viable option. Well, let's back up in time to the time of Cyrus the Great. As John Gill says, in the times of Cyrus, Elam was made a part of the Persian Empire. Cyrus defeated Elam in 540, according to the website thecollector.com. Worldhistory.org has Cyrus defeating Elam in 539, and circa 539, so it was sometime around that time. It's right around the time that Cyrus the Great beat Babylonia. He also beat Elam. That's option number two. That's an option that I don't hold to. I'll tell you why in a minute. Option number three is what I think is the correct option. This is Clark and Gill's option. It was Nebuchadnezzar who put the hurt on Elam. We know that the Babylonians had conquered Elam at some time previous to the Persians conquering Elam. We know that because we see Daniel in Susa, which is the capital of Elam. In Daniel 8, 1 through 2, we read this. In Daniel 8, verses 1 and 2, we read this. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, King Belshazzar was the last ruling king or regent of Babylon when the Persians wiped him out in 539. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, a vision appeared to me, Daniel. I saw the vision, and as I watched, I was in the fortress city of Susa in the province of Elam. So during the reign of King Belshazzar of Babylon, Daniel says, I'm in Elam. So that shows that Babylonia was ruling Elam. So Babylon must have conquered Elam at some time prior to the conquest of Elam by Persia. Now, I couldn't find any historical reference to this conquest, probably because there's not any. The ancient records are oftentimes full of holes, but I believe this is the correct option because of Daniel 8, verses 1 through 2. Daniel is down there working in Susa under a Babylonian king, and also all the other nations which are being prophesied by Jeremiah at the end of his book, chapters 47 through the first part of chapter 49. They all talk about Nebuchadnezzar coming to wipe the nation out. So why would not the same Nebuchadnezzar be destroying Elam? So we're going to take it as Nebuchadnezzar wiping out Elam. In verse 35, God says, I will break the bow of Elam. That's significant because the Elamites were famous for their archery. Isaiah 22, verse 6 refers to this. Elam took up a quiver with chariots and horsemen, a quiver full of arrows. The ancient Greek geographer and historian Strabo and the ancient Roman historian Livy and other ancient historians speak of the Elamites' eminence in archery. Now in verse 36, four is mentioned three times. I will bring against Elam the four winds from the four quarters of the heavens. I will scatter them to the four winds. We say the four corners of the world. It's a common metaphor. Some people say that that refers to the four successor kings of Alexander, and they're trying to make the case that the destruction of Elam happened during Alexander's time, 330 BC, rather than sometime before 539 BC under Nebuchadnezzar. I don't think so. That's my opinion. I think that's just a reference to the four corners of the earth. Now we look at verse 39, the last verse. Yahweh says, I will restore the fortunes of Elam in days to come. Well, when did that happen? Ellicott sets the stage for this by saying of the special history of Elam, as distinct from the other provinces of the Persian Empire, history records but little. So that makes it difficult. Well, let's look at three options. Option number one, the Elamites were restored in the times of Cyrus. Cyrus, of course, being famous for giving liberty to his conquered provinces, just like he gave liberty to the Jews to go rebuild their temple in 538 or so. And so the theory is that Cyrus did the same thing for the Elamites. Now, of course, this option assumes that the destruction of Elam was by Babylon sometime before 539, and it was not destroyed by Cyrus, because Cyrus would not be destroying Judah and then restoring Judah. That would make no sense. And that's what I tentatively believe, that Jeremiah is saying Elam will be destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar and restored by Cyrus. That fits what happened with the Jews. Another possibility is that the Elamites recovered their liberty under the Seleucids, or the Seleucids. Those were the successor kings to Alexander the Great. Alexander died in 323 BC, so we're talking about a couple hundred years later. The Seleucids gave some autonomy to the Elamites. Moving forward in time, some people say that the Elamites were restored in the times of the Messiah. This is Gill and Clark who mentioned this. Acts 2 verse 9, referring to all the Jews who came from outside of Jerusalem to Jerusalem for the Pentecost feast, and at which the Holy Spirit fell, Parthians, Medes, Elamites. So Elamites were there at Pentecost. So we assume that Jews had settled in Elam, maybe after the dispersions in 722 and 586. They got saved at Pentecost. Ellicott says the mention of Elamites among those who were present at Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost shows that they were a recognized province under the Parthian monarchy, and that Jews had settled among them in large numbers, and so supplies a partial fulfillment of their return from their captivity. So Elam is restored because Jews in Elam got saved in the times of the Messiah. And of course, you can always say that the return of the Elamites under Cyrus would be a type for those who are coming into the kingdom at the times of Jesus. Now, one last thing to consider before we close it down. In verse 39, I will restore the fortunes of Elam in days to come. There's two ways you can interpret days to come. It could be days of the Messiah, as in latter days. If so, then what Jeremiah is referring to here is the spiritual conversions of the Elamites in times of Jesus. And of course, Elam could just be a symbol for Gentiles in general getting saved. That's typically what the commentators go to. It always seems a little fuzzy to me. Or in days to come just could mean in many days or many literal days. In other words, just a few years after Jeremiah is prophesying, in which case the restoration under Cyrus, after Cyrus beats Babylon in 539, Cyrus lets Elam be free again, relatively free, that would be a reasonable interpretation of days to come. In other words, just a few short years after Jeremiah is prophesying. The phrase days to come is ambiguous. Well, I am now finished with Jeremiah chapter 49. We're now ready to go to Jeremiah chapter 50. That chapter I will call Judgment on Babylon Part A. We have been reading so much about Babylon coming in and wiping out everybody, including Judah. And now Babylon is going to get theirs. I'm only going to do half of chapter 50. It's too long. I hope you stay tuned for our next audio as we watch Babylon go down to defeat. And I hope you enjoyed this audio.